Welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Here's the host of the show, Bart Blair.
Hey, welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast. This is episode number 44. My name is Bart Blair. I'm the director of church revitalization for Assist Church Expansion. And it's my privilege to welcome you to another episode of our show. We've been producing this podcast for almost 2 years now with the goal of helping churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Thanks again. If you happen to be new to the podcast, make sure that you subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. We release two episodes a month, one of the first of the month, one of the 15th of the month. This month, what month are we in? May of 2026. Hasn't been great. We were late on our first episode, and we're going to be late on this episode as I'm recording this, because today, as I'm recording this, this is May 14th, and it's supposed to be dropping tomorrow. And unless Randall, my son-in-law, who does our post-production, is really, really amazing and fast, it's probably going to be delayed a few days, but that's okay. Hopefully, you'll find the content worth the wait. And if you do find that this content is helpful for you, would you do us a favor and share it with somebody that you know who might be able to benefit from it? Today, my guest is a guy, pastor, named Larry Davis, who is the pastor of a church in Delaware called Grace Seaford. I met Larry back in the early part of 2026 at the Dream Church Conference in Salisbury, Maryland. He was leading a breakout session at that conference on church revitalization. So I went to learn from him, struck up a conversation with him when the workshop was over, and said, I got to have you on my show. And he said, I wrote a book. You should read my book. And so I did. And so what we're going to talk about in this particular interview is some of the overview of his own journey of church revitalization, as well as some of the key points that you'll find in his book, Grieving the Loss of the Church That You Love. And I know that title sounds a little morbid, but yeah, I think you're going to find that this conversation is very, very helpful. So again, thank you for tuning in to the 44th episode of our podcast. Without any further delay, here's my interview with Pastor Larry Davis. Well, Larry, thank you so much for hanging out with me and being my guest on the Revitalize My Church podcast.
Thanks, Bart. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, you and I connected for about 2 minutes at a conference in Maryland earlier this year. And I sat in a workshop that you did and said, I got to talk to this guy. I got to meet this guy, and pitched the idea of you possibly coming onto our podcast at that time. And since then, I've read a book that you wrote, which I think is well, it'll be a centerpiece of our conversation today. And so reached out to you recently, said, let's get on a recording and hear a little bit of your story. And I'm excited to do a bit of an overview of the book, because as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I've read a lot of books on church revitalization and church replanting, and you take an angle that is very different than most people. And I think it actually is very helpful. And I'm looking forward to unpacking a little bit of that with you. Let's start, Larry, by just giving our audience a bit of your ministry background, a bit of your journey, and how you ended up where you are and what you're doing today.
Yeah, sure. So I started actually as an engineer. So I did engineering in the aerospace industry for about 9 years before I got a call to ministry. Was blessed to work with a fast-growing church. It was small when I arrived there. It was a church of about 120 folks, and it was a revitalization. So that was one of my very first upfront seeing what God was doing in the midst of revitalization. Started there as a student pastor. Was a second chair guy. Loved it. Pretty much had every role you can think of in the church. I've been doing this now 26 years as vocational ministry, so it's been a little while. So you can kind of tell, yeah. So I was the executive pastor there, and then I worked with another church and one before that, and saw three revitalizations up close. And then I take a fast at the end of every Christmas, and I was the executive pastor over worship arts at a mega church. And that was one of the reasons why I would fast and take a break, because I didn't even like Christmas by the end of 9 services the course of the weekend. Yeah, which was the church you met me at for the conference. Yeah. Great church. But I needed that fast. When I fasted, I was reading a book called Transforming the Rural Church in America by Shannon O'Dell. And he talked about transforming the church. And I could just feel the Lord telling me it's time to step down from this church and go find a church that was dying and take the things I'd been seeing and to implement them in a revitalization. I think part of my heart there, Bart, was that I've seen the church decline in small church America, and I grew up in a town of only about 700 people. And I remember the connection between our local school and our church and how we would do plays at the church. And there was this collaboration. I'm like, that's missing. I think it's really impacting not only our spiritual life, but also our community as Americans. And so I surrendered, walked out of my church with nowhere to go, waiting for the church to revitalize. That was a scary moment. 9 days later, I landed a little church called Grace Seaford Church. They were Grace Baptist Church at the time. There's a story behind that name change. But they were down to about 20 folks. They were thinking about closing their doors. They had been praying for a year, and their prayer life had aligned in a lot of really cool ways that we can talk about if the segment allows us. But long story short, I started there with a renewal revitalization. The church now is a healthy church. Been there for my 11th year starting. We've planted a church, and the church runs about 170 folks, which is a great church family. And we've worked with now over 110 churches to help with revitalization, at least assist, help, or bless them. So that's a little fast journey of my ministry background.
We're going to probably, as we unpack some of the content from the book, we'll talk a little bit more about the application of the things that you learned there at Grace Seaford. But you said it was down to about 20 folks at the time that you got there, about 100, you said about 175 or so now. What's the size of the community that the church is in?
That's a great question, especially when we're talking about churches. The immediate city of Seaford, Delaware, that's where this church is about 8,000 people.
Okay, so it's not a huge city. What's the nearest large city?
Nearest large city would be Salisbury, where we met, and that's a city proper of about 60,000.
And everybody listening to this podcast goes, what? Salisbury? Where's that?
Yeah, it's in the middle of the Delmarva Peninsula. So
yeah, it's another couple of hours from Baltimore. Yeah,
DC is, you go across the bay, and you got this great Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia all in one little place.
Yeah, I met Pastor Brian, who you used to serve with, Brian Moss. He was on our show about a year ago or so, a little over a year ago. Awesome. And I knew of Salisbury because I worked for a children's theater company back in the early 1990s, and I spent a week in Salisbury working with a group of local school kids. Before that time, I had no idea that Salisbury existed. And then when he said he was at this church in Salisbury, I'm like, well, I've actually been there. I've been to a Delmarva Shorebirds game. Okay.
That's right. Brian, I know that. From Texas. He never knew that Salisbury existed either. That was a total Holy Spirit moment brought him here.
Yeah, that's pretty cool story. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the book. The title, right out of the gate, Grieving the Loss of the Church You Love. Ironically, I was just on a call with a leader from a church that I've been doing some coaching with and mentioned the name of the book. And as the name of the book came out of my mouth, I realized I don't know that it really fully conveys the message that is actually delivered in the book. It sounds like the church is done and it's gone, but the purpose of the book is actually really to guide. I think if I were to summarize what I took from it after reading it, is it's really to help a pastor who's trying to lead a church through revitalization, what the emotional ups and downs and sideways are of the people that he is probably leading or trying to lead through revitalization. So let's jump in for starters. The title of the book infers that there's death. We're grieving.
Yes.
There's loss. And I think this challenges the idea that most of us have that churches shouldn't die. And that's what we're here to do, is to prevent them from dying. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of my frustrations. Or it was, I was reading books on revitalization. I was reading books on change management because I was told that was one of the things you wanted to read a lot of. And what I was realizing was that they were telling people, if you just tweak this or fix this, these resident experts were giving these opinions, then your church will begin to flourish. And what I realized was I wasn't seeing the results of what they were saying, especially with the networks where I was working. And the things that they were sharing, while there were some really good truths and some really good leadership things in there, there were some things that were missing. And this was the big thing that was missing. I sat down with a brainiac, by the way, if you ever want to talk to a guy named Randy Millwood. Randy Millwood's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. He's down in Louisiana, and he's a seminary professor, got a PhD in the way the adult brain works. So that gives you an idea of how crazy Randy is. But I'm getting ready to start my revitalization journey, and Randy asks me this question: does the local church have a natural life cycle? Now, he wasn't talking about the big C. You know, Jesus is going to build his church. The gates of hell can't prevail against it. But he's talking about the local church. And when he's talking about the local church, I had to think about it. And I said, you know, Randy, I want to respond from scripture. And the only scripture I could think of was Revelations chapter 2 and 3. And then I realized every single one of the churches in Asia Minor no longer gather in that form. And it was within 1 to 2 generations that they didn't gather in that form anymore. And it began making me ask the question, why, if we have this in scripture, do we then say it's not natural for the church to go through a life cycle? And then that's when it dawned on me, the church does go through a natural life cycle. And the death, burial, and resurrection cycle is how we come to Jesus, and it's also how he renews his church. So those realities, as I began to really meditate on them, changed the way I thought about church revitalization. And it's really what drove the book. By the way, I want to make sure, do you hear my dogs going crazy in the other room?
I heard a slight little bark.
Okay.
Nothing crazy. Okay. We got dogs going. The dogs are going.
Okay, good.
That's all right. Yeah, no, it's totally fine.
Now you probably
heard. Now I heard the dogs. That's fun. Okay. let's talk a little bit about, like, it's interesting. The death, the burial, the resurrection of a church. Mm-hmm. I think I kind of asked you this question in your workshop.
The breakout you're at.
Like, how do we know? What are the signs that a church is dead mm-hmm. and buried?
Yeah. So metrics are very interesting. I think most people struggle with this, but I'm just going to be blunt. I think if the church is not seeing baptisms, it's not seeing evangelistic growth, if the church is not seeing new families come into the church, so some of it is numeric, but you also begin to sense that the church's prayer life shifts from an outward place to the mission of Christ to more of an inward place. And they start to pray more about their aches and their pains and their O's and their woes and all of the things they're lamenting, but they're not really thinking about the mission and how they're connecting with the mission of Christ as far as their heart is concerned. And you'll see it. It's a slow decline. It's a slow fade. I think that's one of the things that you're looking for. They literally will lose their heart about the mission that Jesus gave his life for. So that's one of the indications. The other thing I would caution people to think about when we talk about the death, burial, and resurrection cycle is we have a Savior who was born with an idea that he was going to die. And so somehow we avoid this. And even in Paul's writings, he talks about embracing the cross. And Bonhoeffer talks about the Christian journey, about a call to come and die, right? So somehow in American theology or American culture, we think the church has to live. And my idea is that the church will live if they will surrender spiritually to death. So they get a choice. A physical death may come or spiritual death will come. And what I've seen, I don't know if it's been your experience, is churches that go through this cycle and continue to live and to grow and to do new things, the church that always emerges on the other side is a different church than the church that comes into the change process. So that's why I embrace this idea of death, burial, resurrection.
Yeah, you're kind of describing. This thought came to my mind. If we mm-hmm. If we had an EKG for
yes.
the local church, the EKG, and this is hard, especially for some of the saints that are clinging to churches mm-hmm. that have long passed probably their prime years of kingdom impact. Baptisms, salvation, yeah. and an outward missional focus of prayer. Yeah. And if yeah. those three things are not consistently showing up in the life of the church, it's probably on its deathbed.
Yeah. And I would say if you want to go deeper with that, I'd read Autopsy of a Deceased Church by Rainer. I think he does a yeah. good job of looking at what the commonalities are across denominations of yeah. what those declines look like.
Yeah, that's one of the early books that I read as I began working with churches, and you quote it several times in your book. Tom Rainer is known as the church mortician because he wrote a book called Autopsy of a Deceased Church. Yeah. Now, there's a phrase that you use in the book. I don't know if I have it exactly mm-hmm. right here, but it says, the attempts to lead change in a church clinging to a false promise of life may cause more harm than good.
Yeah.
The intentions are good, that we're still gathering together. We still have a pastor or someone who's spiritually feeding us, and we're worshiping together, and we're having fellowship, and we're doing things that look and feel like the church that we know and love. But you're telling us that holding on to that may actually be hurting us more than it's helping us.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple examples of that. And some of these come out of very fragile situations. Working with pastors, I've seen pastors that they know their church is dying. They see the decline. They know if they don't right the ship that you know, it's going to lead to a physical death. And then they begin to try to implement a change. And they try to implement that change while the church, and we'll get into this, is in a grieving part of the cycle. And if you try to implement change before a church is ready to receive change, they will react viscerally. They will probably remove the pastor, ostracize the pastor. I've seen some really horrible situations that become harmful to the pastor and to the leadership group of the church. Because some of those are elder-led, you know, just depends on the polity of the church. But they get really nasty. And I'm sure you've seen some of those as well. And I think most of those moments come because they try to implement and lead change before the church is ready to embrace change. And you would ask kind of what the philosophy was of how this came about. Well, if you read John Carter, who is the expert in change management, eighth steps, you know, he has all the books on it. He got his idea about change from Kubler-Ross's book on the five stages of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And the principle that's there that I dug out in some graduate work was that people have a difficult time embracing something that's new until they can actually work through the process of grieving what was. And that's what I mean when I say they're clinging to that. So if a church is clinging to these little things of hope that aren't real hope, they're actually hope not based on a resurrection Jesus is bringing, they're hope based on little tweaks of management, it's going to do more harm than good in the long term. Does that help?
Yeah. No, that's really helpful. In fact, one of the things we began to implement this last 12, 14 months or so, and we took this from, the North Carolina Baptist, Terry Long, who quoted a lot on this podcast. He's actually going to be a guest on a show later this year. We started doing a revitalization readiness assessment. We would go in and we would do a health assessment of the church. And we could do a health assessment of the church and we could actually say, see, your evangelism is weak, your outreach is weak, your fellowship is weak, your discipleship is weak. You're sick in all these areas, so we should come in and fix you. And then we would begin to work a process, and you know, you've been there. We wouldn't find the success that we were looking for, even though we would take it slowly. Because what we were failing to do was we were failing to assess the readiness of the people in the church and spending enough time preparing them for the process that we were going to be working through. So we raced from health assessment to process. Now we've gone health assessment, readiness assessment, and then we're spending more time with the church preparing them for readiness before actually moving into the revitalization process.
That's genius, Mark. I mean, I think what you're describing and that I discovered as well is that the church has to get to a certain place before they're able to receive those kind of changes. And, you know, in my book, what I wrote, and I think it's similar to what you're doing, you can approach this from different ways. There's more than one way to see renewal and revitalization in the church. Mine was, I wanted to give the pastor a context to love the church and shepherd the church through the change. So that's where the five stages came into play, because I knew most pastors knew how to help a person grieve. And so the church grieves, the people grieve what was, so then we can actually then move on to what God wants to do, which could be quite unique depending on their church and their situation.
Yeah, let's double click on that, because really the premise of the book, the structure walks the church leader through the stages of grief, Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, which we know, and you talk about this in the book, they're not linear. We know they're not linear. Anybody who's ever experienced a deep level of grief understands that, you know, you can be through one of the stages and then all of a sudden find yourself back there. It's not a linear path from beginning to end. But let's talk through those stages of grief. And can you just briefly describe how each one of those kind of manifests itself in a local church that is dying or has died? And here's a reality. People grieve often when they know a loved one is going to die, they begin grieving. So this is not saying, hey, the church is dead, gone, buried, long gone. You don't have it to cling to anymore. You can be grieving something that you're losing while you're losing it, even if it's not already fully lost. So why don't you walk us through that and kind of anchor that in what your experience in the church has been?
So let me walk through a few of those. So denial looks like this, and I think most people recognize this one right away, is the church isn't even admitting that there's a problem. There is no problem. This is the way the church is supposed to be. When you move into bargaining, that's where they start to try to figure out ways to deal with the situation without actually experiencing radical change. So we just need a younger pastor. I think that's one of the worst ones. Let's get a younger pastor with a younger family, and they'll reach young families, and our church will live. Horrible bargain. Almost never works. Had one church that had a bargain. If they had fresh letters on their sign, then people driving by would know they were there. And that was an interesting bargain that we had to work through. Anger begins to
right, almost like, stop there. You bought them the letters to the sign. And what happened? Did.
Yeah, because I think there are certain bargains that you have to let the church work through. They need to see that that bargain's not going to work so they can grieve through it. Some bargains, you don't let them work through.
So you're trying to tell me that you got them new letters for the sign and it didn't revive the church?
They didn't grow. No, they didn't grow.
All right.
It continues to die. We're still waiting on them to get to the place they need to be, to your point, that we can help with renewal and revitalization. And then anger, you're going to see things where they want to point the finger at usually everybody except for themselves and really own the problem. They'll blame the pastor. One of the most interesting ones I've seen is they blame the community around them. The community is just not spiritual enough. They're not interested in the faith. So they would rather blame other people because of their anger. And I've seen anger come out in that way than still embracing actually the situation that they're going through. Depression, of course, is the place where they start to finally realize that they really are declining and the church is going to die. And in the book, this one was the surprise for me. So I had some surprises also writing the book, was there's a difference in two types of depression. You know, one type of depression is a depression that's secondary, that's actually because something's happening, you can deal with those types of depression. But the other one, which blew me away, was there's a type of depression when someone's dying that's preparatory. And preparatory depression is the kind of depression that they need to go through because it prepares them to actually accept the reality of what's coming their way. Those were very interesting to go through in the book. And then acceptance, of course, is the place where they're accepting their fate and they're ready to accept whatever's coming next.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks for walking through those. Now, we're going to put this in context at Grace Seaford for a moment. And this is really timely because the way that this podcast works is we release two episodes every month, one on the 1st and one on the 15th. This episode that you and I are recording is dropping between two episodes that my colleague Nathan and I are recording, parts one and parts two, on how to handle resistance in a church revitalization. Okay. So you write in the book about how some of the longtime members at Grace, what is now Grace Seaford, were angry. They were not happy with you. They were resisting where you were trying to take them. How did you handle that? And what were some of the things that you learned in that process?
Yeah. So there's a lot in that to unpack. So I'd say the first thing is the core team that's praying, this is very important, has come to a place of acceptance. So you can revitalize a church without everybody being on the same page, but the core team must be on the page that the church has come to a place of death and that you're going to go through a renewal and revitalization process. That's key. So I had a core team, and I would meet with that core team every Sunday afternoon, and we would talk about any change that we were going to implement, anything that we thought was going to help with the church turning toward health. An example of that would be our church was Baptist, still is Baptist, but they don't operate as Baptist as they used to be. So to join our church, you would have to walk the aisle. You would raise your hand and say, I want to join this church. A deacon would grab a clipboard and say, well, are you born again? And you may not even know what that means. You say, sure. And then they'd say, have you been scripturally baptized? They're like, yeah, sure. And they would check those two things and you feel like you're in alignment with this church. Yes. And they would turn them around, introduce them to the congregation, and they would vote on them. Mm. And then they would be a part of the church if they got voted in. In the history of the church, no one ever got voted out. That was interesting. But they would get voted in, completely congregational. not really a disciple-making situation. So I went to the church and I said, I would like to have a disciple class where we introduce people to some of these principles about our church. And our team, I went through all the reasons why this is very important. I made sure that my core team understood the why. They knew why we were implementing this, how it impacted the church, and what the expected result would be for the church. And then we would have Wednesday night suppers. At the Wednesday night suppers, that's when the anger would flare and come out. We would introduce this new idea. People would stand and they would be upset about the change or why this change. And this was key. If I was the one to stand and defend, they would just say, oh, it's just the new pastor with the new ideas. But I didn't. I have like an 80-year-old deacon stand up and they would explain the why and how they thought it was going to help us to better make disciples and reach people with the gospel. And that would always win the day because they were not going to argue with the people that were the saints of that church that had brought it where it was. But that's one example. And I give one of those examples in the book. It's huge. Another way is, of course, relationally. I don't think pastors like to hear this, but it's really necessary. You need to go to your detractors and spend time with them. So some of the people that were the biggest, you know, opponents of change, what we wanted to do, I would have lunch with them or I'd have coffee with them. And so that's the first step. I think it's very Matthew 18, you know, oriented. And sometimes we resolve some of those tensions that way. But the biggest way was, because the other thing I realized, and I'm sure you realized doing this, Bart, is after we had the supper, after we had the meeting, what do you think those people did in reality? They went around, gathered their people, gathered their group, tried to find the people that agreed with them on what the issue was. But by then, the leadership of the church was on board and the momentum had already shifted. So that's why I think it's key that you have two meetings. You have the meeting with your core leaders, that's the meeting before the meeting, but then you have some type of congregational gathering where you're actually then explaining that through your team to the church. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, in our format structure, and we've actually recorded podcast episodes on this, we use what we call cascading communication, where you typically have, we would typically work in three rings. You have your inner circle, which are the people who are really the primary decision makers in the church. Maybe, you know, depending on your governance, you know, maybe, or your polity, maybe it's a pastor and elders, maybe it's pastor and deacons, maybe you've got a council, but you've got the primary decision makers in the church, and they're the first ones that you need to get unity with. Yes. Then we actually go, instead of going straight out to the congregation, which is the most common thing that people will do, we actually say, you need to actually bring in your key stakeholders who are not primary decision makers. And you need to win them over. Because if you take it to the congregation and you say, this is what we're going to do, and Sally doesn't like what you're going to do, and she looks over at Susie, who is one of those key stakeholders, and Susie's like, I don't know, this is the first I've ever heard about it. You just lost. You lost. You need Susie to be online before you bring Sally up to speed, or whatever the names were. I don't know why I picked those names, but I just confused myself.
At least it wasn't negative Nancy. That's the one that poor Nancy.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned John Cotter earlier. His book, Our Iceberg is Melting. Have you read that one? Yeah. And one of the penguins is named No-No. And why is No-No called No-No? Because No-No says no about everything. We all know the No-No in our church. That's really helpful, Larry. Let's flip to the resurrection side of this, because you talked about, and this is the piece I think that a lot of churches that talk about, you know, we talk about replanting. I know that you're a Mark Clifton fan. I'm a big Mark Clifton fan. Mark Clifton is the replanting, you know, he's a replanter. Yeah. Talk about replanting. Replanting doesn't sound the same as resurrection. And I think it's really difficult sometimes to kind of discern what a replant actually looks like, or maybe what a resurrection looks like. Your book doesn't end with the funeral. We don't go, okay, the church is gone, the church is done. We actually finish with a resurrection. Can you talk a little bit about what that actually looks like for a church, and that you've walked through this whole grieving process, and then we're moving towards revitalization?
Yeah, it's going to be unique, of course, to the church. And the reason, excuse me, it's going to be unique is the prayer process that's prescribed in the book leads them to a place where they can accept whatever the Lord's doing. So for a church, it literally could be the merger with another church in their community. Maybe not even of their denomination, right? We're working on a merger right now, not far from us. It could be a replant. It could, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. It could also be like our church, where the church kind of came to a place where they knew things had died down, and we just started implementing healthy systems. And over time, the church began to grow. We started reaching families in the community, and we saw explosive growth within the first 6 months. Wow. So all those things can be possible. Mark Clifton, when I first heard him, by the way, in Atlanta, Georgia, which was about 12 years ago, did not prescribe replanting all the time. That became, I think, a denominational shift for a lot of people. But he actually described five different methods, and I've got them written down somewhere, that were common methods of revitalization. And what I've learned is that you can't box God in even with those five. So the Lord might do something crazy like, hey, we're going to shut your church down. It's going to become a clothing closet. It's going to become a pantry for the community. And you're going to do that for the next 6 months as you gain traction in rebuilding relationships with this community. And then you're going to birth back into Bible studies. And those Bible studies will then birth back into what your church is going to do in gathering within the next year. I can't prescribe those. That was the reason why I wanted people to go through a prayer journey. Mm-hmm. So that resurrection will look radically different for every single church that goes through it. And their prayer life is where they're going to be guided to that next step. But it also, for some churches, will be a natural death. Unfortunately, that is a possibility. And in the book, I actually talk about a church that went through a natural death, and we actually had a funeral for them. Mm-hmm. We celebrated their ministry, celebrated what God did. And then with that church, what happened was the church property, unfortunately, got sold. The building got sold, and it got reinvested in church plants within about an hour of them. So in a way, we saw renewal and rebirth with that church, but it had to go through an actual physical death.
Yeah, it can look very different. And I think, you know, that's the hardest thing, I think, for I've seen a number of churches get to a place where they, you know, they literally give up the ghost. They're like, okay, we're done. Mm-hmm. We have to shut it down. We have to liquidate, and we're moving on. And it's always really sad when that happens. But there can always be a silver lining to that if those mm-hmm. resources are reinvested in more kingdom work. You know, I've jokingly said, you know, my wife and I, you know, travel quite a bit with the work and the ministry work that we do. And I have been in restaurants and coffee shops and microbreweries that are all like former mm-hmm. church buildings. And I've mm-hmm. said that my role in our fellowship of churches is to ensure that none of our churches become coffee shops. Like that's what they could have a coffee shop. I don't care if your church has a coffee shop. I just don't want your church building to become a coffee shop.
A church in New York where Tozer preached, A.W. Tozer, is now a pizza place. You literally can see an area where the altar used to be, but it's a pizza place. And you're right. I don't think anyone wants that to happen. But I think when it happens, it's because there was a church very resistant to the change that God wanted to bring. I come back to that Revelation 3:20. If the Lord is really knocking on the door and he said he'll build his church, if we'll let him come in and do whatever he really wants to do, he'll build his church. But that means we're going to have to come to a spiritual death to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge for most churches is that they linger in an unhealthy place for too long.
And, yeah, absolutely.
You know, if a pastor or church leader can recognize earlier on that there is no quick fix, there is no silver bullet, your church is trending in the wrong direction, reach out and get the help early. And I think you have a much better chance. I mean, it's just like with any disease. If you're going to the doctor regularly and they find out that you have something wrong with you, better chance of healthy recovery if it's caught early. And the same thing is true with a church that's unhealthy, that's trending in the wrong direction. The problem is, I think, you know, we get so myopic in terms of what we think and believe the church needs to be, which is why I like your EKG measurables there, right?
Yeah.
Are people getting saved? Are people getting baptized? And is our prayer life inward or outward focused?
And your budget's another one he brings up. Is your budget focused outward or is it inward? And you bring up something in the book that I try to cautiously approach. I'm not an expert at it, but you know, if your church is just starting the decline, that's not a death. That's a, right. That is a time where change just needs to be brought to the church itself to change. And but Rainer talks about four churches, healthy, showing signs of disease, like you're talking about. But then he talks about those that are beginning a process of active death, and then, or I think he calls it dying, but then actively dying. So he breaks into four different categories. And what I prescribe for in the book is for those last two.
Yeah.
I think that's important. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's tie a bow on this. This has been a great conversation. I love finding people in the world that have a kindred spirit in this space of really wanting to help churches get healthy and be healthy. Tell people where they can find the book, any other resources that you have available that might be accessible for people.
Yeah, sure. So you can get on Amazon, you can get on Noble, Barnes and Noble. I mean, it's pretty easy to get. My publisher's got it as well, but I would say Amazon's probably the easiest place to grab it. It amazes me how they just print stuff as it's needed, you know. I have a website. They made me get a website. It felt very narcissistic doing this, to be a little transparent. I had to create a PastorLarryDavis.com website. And when I was creating it, I'm like, this does not sound very Christ-like, but they said it's so you can market it and connect with people. So a lot of resources are there. And like you, Bart, I'll do sometimes a podcast with another revitalizer to share it from there to help other people. I'll probably share yours there as well because I want to help other pastors. I will do consulting like you if the church is looking for that. All the information at the website's there, PastorLarryDavis.com. And then I'm writing a second book, believe it or not.
You mentioned that in your breakout. Tell us a little bit about that second book. I don't think it has anything to do with the revitalization, though.
No. So the first book, listen, the reason I wrote the first book, I felt a serious, deep conviction to write that book. It was a painful and very emotional book to write. And it took a lot from me. And so the other thing I realized about grief, and maybe you've realized this, is when you get people together that have a common affinity, they begin to tell stories, and those stories are healing. And I noticed that when pastors and leaders and elders or deacons, leaders of the church got together, it wasn't long before they started telling stories to outdo the other person. Have you noticed that? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you think that's a bad funeral story? Oh, you think that's a bad wedding? And they would just amplify. And I noticed that it was healing. They would laugh, and they would begin to laugh about ministry and some of the ludicrous aspects of ministry. And so I thought, man, it would be great to collect those and then just publish them for fun, and then use all the proceeds from the sales to put aside to help pastors go get counseling that need it and avoid it. So that's the goal. It's the book's called "You Wouldn't Believe Me If I Told You," and some of the stories are just so insane, and you just laugh. And so that was the purpose of the book. So far, when I've shared it, it has a broader appeal to a lot of people, and some of the stories are just, like I said, they're ludicrous. I had to ask my wife for permission for some of them, especially for my Episcopal brothers.
Okay.
When those came over, I'm like, is this an appropriate story for the book? And my wife says, yeah, you're going to tweak it some, but it can fit. So,
keep it G-rated. Is that book available now?
It's going to be available by the end of the year. And it's on the website, and I've got it linked. And by the way, you can submit a story. So if you've got a story that you think would heal the church and it's funny or humorous, submit it. And we do change names, places, situations, so that we protect the innocent.
Okay. All right. Very cool. Yeah. Any final words of encouragement for pastors that are in the middle of leading their church through a renewal and a revitalization process?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I would say is do not get discouraged, and that they should network with guys like you, guys like me. There are networks out there of people that want to pull alongside of leaders in the church and pastors to help them. So that would be the first thing I would say is you're not alone. You may feel like you're alone. You may feel isolated. You're not. And having the authenticity or the guts to just reach out and say there's an issue and ask people to help can make a big difference. That would be the biggest thing I would say. And there's lots of resources. I would also caution them to not jump into one that's all about the money. There's a lot of coaching networks out there that if you just join our network, buy our material, get our, you know, I would avoid those. Those seem like pyramid schemes to me for revitalization. It's like the Amway of revitalization. Sorry, Amway. But anyway, I would say look for the networks there that are local to support you. So that would be my greatest piece of advice.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. The book is called Grieving the Loss of the Church You Love. It does have a happy ending. And so I would just encourage those of you who are out there, I downloaded it off of Amazon so I could read it on my Kindle and highlight my notes in it. And Larry, I really appreciate you hanging out with me today. We'll link to all of your website and the book and everything in the show notes of this podcast episode. So thanks for hanging out with me. For those of you who have made it all the way to the end of this episode, thanks for hanging in with us. As a reminder, again, we release 2 episodes every month, and the best way for you to never miss one is to be sure that you subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And if you're watching on our YouTube channel, leave us a comment. I'll be happy to engage with you there. You can check out our website at revitalizemy.church. where we have some other resources, some tools that you can use, and you can check out the archives of all of our podcast episodes. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.